we have to remember that success is child by child and failure is child by child.
Alaska's schools receive their No Child Left Behind grades. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 8th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, concerns over state jobs migrating away from the capital city.
At some point, they're going to have central government relocated completely out of Juneau.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, where now and in the future, it's a priority to hire qualified Alaskans first.
After 5 years of steady, if sometimes incremental, improvement, the latest report from the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development shows that the percentage of Alaska public schools making adequate yearly progress as defined by the federal No Child Left Behind Act has dropped. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Alaska Education Commissioner Larry Ledoux presented the 2007-2008 AYP, Adequate Yearly Progress Report, this morning in Anchorage. It showed that of just over 500 public schools, slightly more than 290 of them met AYP goals. That's 59% compared to almost 66% last year. As he pointed out the decline, Ledoux described a factor that somewhat clouded the results.
To interpret this year's results, you need to know that the targets for the 2007-2008 school year have increased. The result is that some schools that made AYP last year and improved this year did not meet or exceed these new targets. Other schools, frankly, are flat in their assessment results. There hasn't been a lot of change or growth. And some schools remain far behind our expectations.
From 2004 through 2007, schools met the language arts objective if approximately 72% of the students passed. Last year, that became 77%. Likewise, in mathematics, the objective rose from about 58% to just over 66%. The tests cover students in 3rd through 10th grades. The drop between this last year and the previous school term is somewhat similar to 2003-2004 and 2004-2005. That was when the objectives rose for the first time. In that case, the percentage of schools meeting AYP didn't actually drop, but remained almost identical to the previous year. And while some schools that didn't make AYP in 2007-2008 still showed progress, the number of those failing to progress or falling behind has grown.
There are some districts and schools that are showing showing low scores, and there are districts that we are working closely with to provide support. And the number of districts probably meriting that support has increased this year.
Consecutive years of failure to meet federal AYP goals can slide schools and districts into various levels of consequences. Some demand more concerted, planned efforts at student improvement. The most severe, taking place after years of failure, can result in administrative and staff reorganization. Ledoux noted that it's the state's role to help consistently troubled districts and schools to achieve AYP, not harass them. Often that help takes the form of state personnel who can analyze the effectiveness of various district or, in the future, individual school programs. But, Ledoux says, the Department of Education can only do so much.
Any kind of intervention has to be community-based. To assume that the state can go into a community and, through some simple changes, increase scores is not going to happen. The state needs to work collaboratively with communities to increase student achievement.
Ledoux pointed out another difficulty accompanying a bulky report like AYP. It sometimes obscures the most important element of all.
We must put a child's face on everything that we talk about. So when we talk about statistics, whether a school made AYP or whether they didn't, we have to remember that success is child by child and failure is child by child.
The AYP report is available online at the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development website. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
State officials are relocating some Juneau jobs to Anchorage or Fairbanks when they fail to fill job openings advertised for the capital city. Information technology positions are among those that have been moved away from Juneau. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
Administration Commissioner Annette Kreitzer says the state is having difficulty filling some of its openings in the capital city. When that happens, she says she makes sure hiring managers have recruited statewide and nationwide for the position and that they've removed any unnecessary requirements from the listed job qualifications.
If we've done all of those things and we still cannot fill the position in Juneau and the work still needs to be done, then I, in my department, will have to move that job to a location where we can fill the position.
Does that translate into Anchorage or?
It could be Anchorage. It could be Fairbanks. It depends on what makes sense, you know, where the person can be supervised appropriately.
Kreitzer says not all jobs, only mission-critical jobs, fall under this policy. Juneau officials and lawmakers are upset that the Palin administration has a policy in place that moves any jobs away from the capital city. Assemblyman Bob Dahl says problems hiring state workers reflect the wages and benefits being offered.
I think all of those go into make up the attractiveness or the lack of it, as the case may be, of state positions in Juneau. And I think that the unattractiveness of those is not a healthy condition for Juneau, and I think needs to be reversed.
Dahl learned of the policy to move unfilled job openings away from Juneau after his wife, Representative Andrea Dahl, discussed it with Commissioner Kreitzer. Kreitzer says she's well aware of the Juneau delegation's concerns about losing jobs.
But if the work is that important and it needs to be done, then it needs to be done. And I'm not going to be able to let a position sit vacant for some unspecified period of time. I move positions very reluctantly. I'm not in a rush to do that.
Kreitzer, who works in Juneau, says she's been taking this approach since she became commissioner a year and a half ago, but she says she's aware of only a small number of jobs that have been relocated.
In terms of ones that have gotten my attention directly, there have been very few, I think probably five. But in terms of positions that have been moved statewide and with all departments in Juneau, I do not know.
Jim Duncan with the Alaska State Employees Association in Anchorage says the state has a hard time recruiting employees because its retirement benefits have dwindled and its wages haven't kept up with inflation.
Changing a location doesn't address the real root of the problem. In fact, it probably causes even a greater difficulty because at some point they're going to have central government relocated completely out of Juneau. So I'm very concerned about this and don't believe that this is a process that the commissioner needs to follow.
The state's current wage scales put Juneau at a bit of a disadvantage in competing with other Alaskan cities for state workers. The state increases its salaries in Fairbanks and in some rural locations to account for the higher cost of living there. But it does not do so in the capital city. The Juneau Economic Development Council says the cost of living was about 7% higher in Juneau than in Anchorage last year. Juneau's cost of living was also slightly higher than Fairbanks. Kreitzer says the state is currently seeking proposals for an economic study so it can update its regional cost of living adjustments for the first time in more than a decade. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an incredible story of survival in the Alaska wilderness.
Each one got a square out of the candy bar in a day, and then they could have it any time of the day they wanted, but it was only one.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
The city of Nenana continues to deal with fallout from this week's flooding. The city issued a boil water order yesterday. Nenana Mayor Jason Mayran says the directive was due to concerns that city water has been compromised.
The boil water is a precaution, but it's a prudent precaution because until we have test results back, we don't know whether or not there's any contamination in the system.
Mehran says test results are not expected back until later today. Residents are advised to boil water vigorously for 1 minute before consuming it or washing with it. The city has also requested bottled water and bleach from the state. Water will be available at the Nenana Fire Hall. Meanwhile, portable toilets are available at several locations in town, and a honey bucket tank has been set up. Mehran says the city sewer system is slowly being brought back online.
The system did incur quite a bit of damage, obviously with the high amount of water that was going down in there and the silt and dirt that was washing into the system from the waters that were overflowing.
Mehran says parts coming down from Fairbanks today will aid repair of the sewer system. The weather was rainy again today in Nenana, and several streets there remained underwater despite pumps running around the clock. People are being advised to avoid prolonged contact with floodwaters. The Department of Environmental Conservation is in the process of testing fuel tanks and wells for leaks and contamination. The state of Alaska is trying to get out the word on the importance of predator control. As Dan Bross reports from KUAC in Fairbanks, as always, it's a controversial message.
The $400,000 PR campaign includes fold-out glossy pamphlets that were placed in Alaska newspapers this week and radio announcements. Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says the idea is to educate the public on the always controversial topic.
Describing the fact that a lot of Alaskans do rely on wildlife for food and that management of Alaska's wildlife is extremely important and that predator control may be a tool that can be considered in some cases.
The outreach effort comes prior to a vote on a predator control ballot measure later this month and just after negative feedback on a state wolf kill on the Alaska Peninsula. The spring control effort there, which included the killing of wolf pups, was aimed at bringing back a sharply declining caribou population. Independent wildlife scientist Gordon Haber says the state's handling of the kill amounted to deception by omission.
First of all, the way they sold this program by couching it as a biological emergency that the caribou in the southwest Alaska Peninsula would just disappear if they didn't do anything and go extinct. And in fact, they're aware of all the historical data, which says that, you know, that there's been at least a couple of times over the last 130 years when caribou have gone to even lower levels there and still recovered on their own without wolf control. And then the use of denning, killing young pups, they said nothing whatsoever in their press release or anything about 12 of the 28 wolves they killed being 3 or 4 week old pups. That they went to two dens and just one by one picked the pups up and shot them through the head, euthanized them humanely, as they put it.
Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Doug Larson stands by the actions. Larson says southern Alaska Peninsula caribou have plummeted from 10,000 to just 600 animals, and wolf predation is the reason.
In our minds, the way to arrest that decline was to go in and do predator control. Although it's not a pleasant thing to do, it was given the objectives for arresting that decline in caribou, it was the right thing to do, and we did it.
Larson says some of the wolves were shot from a helicopter. He says the state didn't mention that the take included pups in a June press release because it didn't consider the age of the wolves important. The Game Board-approved effort veered from other current predator control programs, which use public pilot gunner teams to target wolves in 5 areas of the state during winter months. The Alaska Peninsula wolf kill was the first to use state employees since a snaring program that ended in 1994. Larson says this spring's hunt was unusual and does not signal a shift in tactics.
This is a pretty unique situation. So, no, I don't think that this is going to become something that's widely used across the state.
When Alaskans go to the polls August 26th, they'll consider a ballot measure which, if approved, would only allow predator control to be conducted by state employees and only in cases of biological emergency. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The emergency fuel assistance measures passed by the legislature yesterday may be just the beginning of a major public policy adjustment to the high price of oil. Renewable energy is the buzzword of the day. Already windmills are popping up all over the bush, and an experimental hydropower turbine is going into the Yukon River at Eagle. Transportation projections are being rethought as commuters drive less and begin pressing for mass transit. One of the speakers at this weekend's Renewable Energy Fair in Anchorage says that places like Alaska will be among the first to make the changes needed to face an era of great energy uncertainty. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Surrounded by the new construction outside downtown Anchorage's City Hall, Daniel Lert said he's here to help city leaders find ways to make their infrastructure more resilient. He says that adaptation is more likely to take place on a local level than nationally and more likely to happen here than elsewhere.
Alaska is at a bit of an advantage. You could even think of it that way, because the public and even the political consensus is going to start developing rather quickly to recognizing that energy uncertainty is a legitimate and urgent issue. You'll get there faster.
Lurch has written Post-Carbon Cities, Planning for Energy and Climate Uncertainty, and was meeting with municipal leaders on Friday. He advocates for what he calls a systems approach to see where the vulnerabilities are to high fuel costs. Is it in how food gets here? In the way the aviation business is changing? In the movement of rural populations into the hubs? Or where? The growing realization that there is no going back from these high fuel prices goes under the name of peak oil. In its simplest form, it's the idea that the world's fossil fuel production is peaked. As Lurch's Post-Carbon Institute puts it, regardless of the vast amount of hydrocarbons still left undiscovered, how much faster can they be produced?
Ultimately, recoverable reserves is absolutely part of the issue. The main issue, however, is flow. Peak oil is the maximum flow rate.
Lurch says this makes it a prudent bet to invest in infrastructure that reduces demand and to do it now.
We have a limited window of opportunity to build infrastructure at a certain price. It's only going to get more expensive. So we have a choice. Do we spend the next 10 years and, you know, invest in renewable energy and invest in, you know, public transit, invest in densifying our cities and building zero energy buildings and that sort of thing? Or we do business as usual and build this very oil intensive land use pattern and end up basically having the same problems 20 years from now, but with far fewer opportunities for changing what we're going to do.
Looking at systems is best done on a local level, Ertz says. While major spending decisions about the Highway Trust Fund or such things as renewable energy tax incentives get made on the national level, only local government has much hope of projecting such things as how land use and demand for municipal services are likely to change.
As we start to have these big changes in the national economy, we're going to have all sorts of different changes at the local levels, and it's only people at the local level who know what local resources are, who can identify what the local vulnerabilities are, and can determine what the local solutions can be and how to prepare for them locally. We can't look to higher levels of government to solve this problem for us.
In his book, Lurch has a list of examples of things local governments are already doing based on 40 interviews with planners, engineers, and public office holders. He says resilience planning is already well known in the business world, and it's time to move it into local government. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Rasmussen Foundation, accepting applications from Alaska artists for project awards. The deadline is September 1st.
This week on AK, an encore from March 2007. The Office. We squelch office rumors. Meet the IT guy and take Fido to the cubicle on AK from APRN.
A nonprofit organization is partnering with the U.S. Forest Service to maintain recreation cabins on the Tongass National Forest. Friends of the Tongass Cabins is a relatively new organization seeking to help the government agency keep the more than 150 remote cabins open and in good shape. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki has more.
The Friends of the Tongass Cabins is a new group of cabin users and businesses that have organized to advocate for the Tongass Cabin program. Joe Parrish is with that group.
The mission that we have is ensuring the continued development
operation and maintenance and public enjoyment of cabins on the Tongass National Forest.
Many of the over 150 cabins and shelters on the Tongass were built in the 1960s and 70s. They're maintained mostly by Forest Service employees, and a number each year are funded for repair work and upgrades. But some structures see little use by the public, and the agency has started tearing down some of the least popular or most run-down sites, and they're considering others for removal. Parrish says the new group could help keep some of the cabins open by offering money or volunteer work.
The Friends creates a place that people can come and put their ideas forward about how to take care of their favorite cabin or cabins and what resources are out there to do so and what pools of volunteers are out there to help and what businesses might be able to contribute.
Friends of the Tongass Cabins has organized as part of another regional nonprofit, the Southeast Alaska Guidance Association, or SAGA. Parrish is SAGA's director, and he's one of the 22-year-old organization's founders. Among other programs, SAGA hires Southeast teens to work during the summer on trail restoration and cabin upkeep projects. The Friends of the Tongass Cabins this May signed an agreement with the Forest Service. It says the group and the agency will meet each year and plan projects for cabin repair work. The Friends will also do public outreach for the Tongass and its cabin program. Parrish says his group will be involved in decisions about which cabins will stay open and which could close.
We are a voice at the table now, and it's a focused voice about how to support a viable and sustained cabin program. And, you know, we serve as an advocate on behalf of the cabins. We keep the public informed of ways they can help and contribute. And we do fundraising, volunteer generation, and, you know, generally work as a catalyst to bring together the different groups that share an interest in maintaining the cabins.
Parrish says the group has raised about $5,500 so far, and they welcome new members and volunteers. The Forest Service has been seeking ways to reduce a backlog of needed maintenance work on their existing cabins, and agency officials say a shrinking budget and smaller workforce make this kind of a partnership necessary. Forest Service spokesman Phil Salmon says the agreement could lead to keeping some cabins open or building others.
The primary reason behind a lot of our cabin closures or the condition of some of our cabins, as most folks could understand, is the budget shortfalls, the budget dilemma that we've faced over the years, as many other federal agencies have. So certainly this partnership could give us the impetus or the reason to leave some of these cabins online, and certainly to look at maybe putting a cabin in a place that would be more popular and closing another cabin that's less used. So, you know, if we have a newer cabin to start with, the maintenance would be lower, so we could actually have better recreational opportunities through this type of partnership.
The new agreement lasts for 5 years. It's available online, along with information about the new cabins group, at www.servealaska.org. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Growing up, John Tippetts remembers hearing his dad, Joe, tell the incredible story of how he survived a plane crash in Southeast Alaska. Now Tippetts has a new book out describing the event. Hearts of Courage recounts how Joe and three others endured 30 days on a mountainside near Ketchikan before finally organizing their own rescue. The crash happened on January 5, 1943, in a plane on its way from Seattle to Anchorage. All five passengers and well-known bush pilot Harold Gillam survived the initial crash. Two, including Gillam, later died. But Tippetts says no one escaped the crash uninjured.
Dad and Gillam, head injuries. Jibo and Metzdorf, serious injuries, broken collarbones, broken ribs, perhaps even a broken back in one case, broken leg. Anyway, serious, serious injuries. Percy Cutting had hurt his back somehow. But the one who was most seriously injured was Susan Botzer. She was really pinned in the wreckage, her arm almost severed just above her wrist. And probably suffering other injuries, internal and external. And she actually died from loss of blood and other injuries, I guess, in 2 days after the accident.
How did they survive as far as food? What did they eat?
You know, a good deal of the book Hearts of Courage is about meals. There were some provisions on the airplane. Dad describes particularly cutting the sardine into four parts. This was when there was just four of them left there. And each one having their piece of sardine, and that was what they got. He says the same, something similar about the candy bar, you know, the kind of the Hershey-style candy bar, and each one got a square out of the candy bar in a day, only one, and then they could have it any time of the day they wanted, but it was only one.
Why was a rescue so difficult? Why did it take so long?
Harold Gillam really only called in once that they had an engine conked out and expected trouble. And that's all the message he left, no indication where they were. Again, Southeast Alaska's rugged country. Because he had called in and knowing how long he had been in the air from Seattle, they kind of figured that he was within a 40 to 60-mile radius of Annette Island, where they were hoping to get that evening. So they had a radius, but that's a radius of lots of water, lots of islands, lots of trees, and lots of mountains.
How did your father make the decision to finally go and find help?
You know, I think they'd realized that there was the search was probably abandoned. And they were right. The timing that they made this decision, the search had pretty much been abandoned. They had now been lost by 3 full weeks. They had used whatever IEDs they had or supplies they had for food. They didn't have any more food. So they really knew that at this point, if they didn't do something on their own, they would die of starvation or freezing or both. So he and Sandy Cutting were both relatively amiable, able to move around and do things. So they made a lean-to at the base of the mountain, cut firewood and set water aside for the two other survivors, Dewey Metzdorf and Robert Gibo. Did everything they could to provide something for them, but then they realized they had to find rescue, find a way to take care of themselves. And they made their way south about 3 miles to a body of water, which we subsequently know as Weasel Cove. And that's where they have another week's worth of adventures. They had planned to go back immediately in 4 days to their companions. But when they got there and realized that going back was just to go back for all of them to die together, they continued to make efforts, and that ultimately led to their rescue.
Did your father describe what it was like to finally see the Coast Guard boat heading toward them?
Yes, he did. And I think every time I heard Dad describe that boat, he would almost swell up in tears. Again, it's been 29 days now at that point. And they'd seen two other boats in previous days and not been rescued. And so they had become totally disheartened. And so when you see one that actually seems to have figured out you're there and is coming towards you, the emotional experience, I think, registered with him all of his life.
John Tippetts is the author of Hearts of Courage. He'll sign copies of the book tonight at 6 at Pandemonium Books in Wasilla and tomorrow at Tidal Wave Books in Anchorage at 11. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, John Ryan in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Medeker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, financial pioneers in Alaska nearly a century ago, bringing Alaskans to the next stage. WellsFargo.com, the next stage. And by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.